Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. We'll stay partly to mostly sunny for the rest of this afternoon, possibly reaching a high temperature of 96. Currently with relative humidity at 7%, it's mostly sunny and 92. Meanwhile, in Valley traffic, an accident on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, that's at Guadalupe. There's also a collision on the off-ramp of the 60 eastbound at Val Vista Drive.
United Healthcare, the country's biggest insurer this week, announced plans to leave the healthcare exchanges in many states, including Arizona, by 2017. Joining me to talk about what this could mean is Marjorie Baldwin, a professor in the economics department at ASU's Carey School of Business. And Marjorie, what does this move say about Arizona, if anything?
I wouldn't say it's so much about Arizona as it is about the structure of the exchanges, because United Healthcare isn't only pulling out of Arizona, it's planning to pull out of all but a handful of states in 2017. So it's not so much anything Arizona is doing so much as the way the exchanges are structured that's just not making them viable to continue.
What is it about the exchanges that's putting them in this position?
Well, the exchanges were designed to be a place where small employers, where individuals who couldn't afford health insurance could purchase insurance. Insurers are obligated to provide health insurance to anyone, whether or not they have pre-existing conditions. The pool of people who are insured in the exchanges was less healthy than anticipated, and so premiums had to increase. When premiums increase, healthier people tend to drop out, and the pool becomes even less healthy, and premiums increase even more. Eventually, it becomes not viable for insurers to even cover the pool, and that's what United Healthcare was finding, that they were just simply losing big money in the insurance exchanges, whereas their other lines of business were making money.
Do you think that this decision and this move will have any significant impact on folks who are insured right now by United Healthcare here in Arizona and who will have to look for a different organization with whom to be insured?
It should not. This is a decision to pull out of the exchanges, so it should not have an impact on people who are insured through United Healthcare through their other product lines. And their other product lines were very profitable in 2016. So it's not that United Healthcare is not viable. It's in particular the exchanges.
I want to clarify something you said about how people who are insured should be okay through United's other product line. What do you mean by that?
They're pulling out of the state health insurance exchange, where they buy health care through the provisions of Obamacare. They're not pulling out of Arizona overall.
So if your employer, for example, has its policies through United Healthcare, you will still keep those. It just won't be an option if you're shopping on the open marketplace.
If you're shopping on the Obamacare marketplace, yes.
You don't think that this will be the last time that we hear about a company doing this?
No, I don't. Three plans pulled out at the end of 2015, and now United Healthcare has said they're pulling out for 2017, and it's just they're pulling out because it's not profitable. If it's not profitable for them, it's not profitable for others. And as they pull out, premiums go up and the choice gets reduced. And as premiums go up, healthy people drop out and it becomes even more expensive for people, for the insurers who are covering this population.
Marjorie Baldwin is a professor in the Department of Economics at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. Marjorie, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yesterday, the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors approved 116 vote centers to be used in the upcoming May 17th special election. That's up from 60 in last month's presidential preference election. Joining me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block to discuss why there is debate on this topic. And first of all, Jude, let's just review what's on the ballot on May 17th. Two propositions.
Right. There is Prop 123. That's the governor's proposal for education financing that uses funding from the state land trust. And Prop 124, which would make changes to the retirement program for public safety employees.
So, Jude, what did supervisors eventually agree to yesterday about the polling centers for May 17th?
So keep in mind, of course, this is the same board that approved the disastrous 60-vote center plan that on March 22nd led to those long lines, voters voting past midnight. So after that debacle, county election officials told the board they'd try and double the number of vote centers for this May 17th election. They got close. They proposed 116 polling places to the board. In a 4-1 vote, the board approved the plan, but also left open the possibility to add additional polling sites.
And the only Democrat on the board, Steve Gallardo, was the no vote. Did he explain why?
Well, yeah. Gallardo said the recorder's office had not done enough to get feedback from the public on the plan. He was saying if the portion of the Voting Rights Act was still in effect that required Arizona to get its election changes approved by the Department of Justice, that the Department of Justice would have required public feedback for these changes. He said he'd heard concerns that there were gaps in the plan for North Phoenix and South Scottsdale. And his colleagues on the board were trying to get him to vote yes. They said, well, why don't we leave open the possibility of adding additional polling places? But this time, Gallardo decided to vote no, I think to make the point that he really wanted more public comment.
And we should note, this is new for Maricopa County to use vote centers, which are larger polling places that any voter can visit. But it also means voters have to travel farther to get to them because there are fewer.
Exactly. And some people have called this the Costco model of voting rather than the local 7-Eleven. So in this kind of election, you have a big destination place with multiple lanes, more poll workers, and voters can go to any of these vote centers in the county versus the other type of election that we're more used to, where voters are bound to only go to their neighborhood precinct close to their homes. March 22nd was the first time we had these vote centers. And while there's a lot of advantages in theory, as we know, it didn't go smoothly.
And what do we know about how future elections will be run after May 17th? Of course, we've got August and November coming up.
Right. And those were going back to the local model. That was actually always the plan. So there's going to be over 700 polling sites, and voters will have to go to their designated polling site. Otherwise, if they cast a ballot anywhere else, it's not going to count. And that's probably going to be pretty confusing.
KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
The demolition of a historic building in Phoenix has led to increased scrutiny of an arrangement called GIPLET, that stands for Government Property Lease Excise Tax, and basically replaces a property tax with an excise tax for property owners. Phoenix officials say there are 12 such GIPLET projects downtown. The issue has come to the fore in the controversy over the Circles building in downtown Phoenix. Bob Graham is principal architect with Motley Design Group in Phoenix. And Bob, how did this arrangement play into what happened with the Circles building?
When the developer's plans really became known, the community really reached out and said, hey, you know, if you're going to ask for this public subsidy in developing your project, it's not good enough just to say I'm bringing a couple of jobs downtown or increasing some economic activity, which is typically what they justify these things on. Because what we really want to see is a public benefit that's clear, and we would like to see you preserve the historic building in return for receiving this tax benefit.
In your mind, what role has this arrangement had in the development of downtown and in some ways, some might say the revitalization of downtown?
Well, it's been a really good thing for the most part. I mean, if those of us who've been downtown since the 80s or even earlier remember when downtown was a very sleepy place, not a lot happening. A lot of people thought it was a very scary place. And in order to incentivize people to reinvest in the inner city, this was one of the few tools the city has available to do that. And so it's been liberally used for probably the last 20 or 30 years in encouraging downtown development. And unfortunately, it's gotten so that pretty much anyone contemplating doing a development in the downtown area is just expecting to receive this GPLAT out of hand. The history on that is that that has been the case. Recently, things have been turning around a little bit. I think the level of economic activity in the downtown area is pretty self-evident that it has really picked up. So in my view, we don't really have a problem encouraging downtown development anymore. And so if we're going to be using these incentives, we should really redirect them to try to direct development into a more sensible, sustainable mode.
It sounds like your feeling is that these GPLATs are good for sort of getting the ball rolling on developing in a certain area. But once it is rolling and once developers see this as a desirable place to be, the city can sort of pull back and say, okay, now let's just sort of let the market do its thing.
I would hope that is the case. Unfortunately, the GPLAT program has turned out to be sort of the economic crack of downtown Phoenix. How do you get off of it? Because up till now, everyone has relied on it, and a lot of the rents and things that have been going on downtown are predicated on receiving this GPLAT. So it's something that I think needs some additional study, but I think it's pretty well recognized amongst most downtown dwellers that this is now a problem.
Well, how does the city, in your mind, get off of this crack, as you call it? Because for new developers coming in, I would imagine they would look at a project and say, this looks great, but, you know, developer X, Y, and Z over here have gotten this program. Why can't I have the same thing?
Yeah, and it's hard. Well, developer X, Y, and Z, hopefully were coming in at a time when nobody else was. And so I credit those guys, and they deserve their incentive for coming down and helping enliven downtown. I think the first step is really to recognize you've got a problem and to make a public policy statement that we're going to try to, you know, we're going to be more judicious in how we award the GPLATs, that we are going to require public participation and public benefit that's clear beyond just the economic activity that you're providing. And so I think you could probably just slowly start to ratchet up the bar to where you can not giving out quite so many of these.
Bob Graham is principal architect with Motley Design Group in Phoenix. Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Kreider is president and CEO of Downtown Phoenix Incorporated. He doesn't think the issue of GPLATs is a dramatic problem. David, is Phoenix at a difficult crossroads when it comes to incentives and preservation?
I think what's happened is that downtown has become this incredibly diverse, robust community, and it's become a place that's just changed remarkably just in the last few years. And I would say there's almost universal support for preservation of historic and vintage buildings within the downtown area. So, you know, we do run into situations where there is conflict, and the preservation community works very hard, you know, to kind of advance and advocate their positions. But there is a lot of interaction and dialogue between the development community and the preservation community and all of the other interests that have coalesced around downtown Phoenix.
Are there certain changes that the city could make? Are there options that could modify things?
I think we in Phoenix would support stronger methods for preservation of historic and vintage buildings. But at the same time, we're in the state of Arizona, and there's very strong private property rights, and you've got to balance those property rights. You can't designate a building as historic right now in the city of Phoenix unless the property owner agrees to that. So I think in a number of the cases where there have been conflict, it's principally because the property owner, you know, is not embracing the historic preservation of the building. In many cases, it could be that the land that the building sits on is entitled for more dense development, and the property owner thinks that they can get a higher value if the building is not there. So you run into those types of conflicts, but they're not very common. And most of the projects where there's a public-private partnership or where the city's using mechanisms to facilitate development are occurring on vacant lots downtown as opposed to lots that have significant buildings on them.
I want to come back to the word you used, robust, talking about downtown, which no question, I mean, things are flying. So does that change the perspective of public-private partnerships? Does it change the perspective of what the city can or should do? Because it's no longer an area necessarily that needs propping up.
I agree that a lot of the private development that's occurring in downtown right now does not need subsidy and support. And the city has actually backed away from the support, public support of projects that historically it has done in the past when we were, grinding away trying to get new residential development downtown, for example. We're really transitioning away from this historic kind of stick-built on a podium residential project product to true high-rise residential development, and it's going to dramatically impact the size of the downtown community. You know, as we move into these unproven elements of the market, those are areas where I think some city support is still appropriate.
GPLET, the government property lease excise tax, a colleague of mine spoke with Bob Graham, who labeled this the economic crack of downtown Phoenix. Now, how do you react to that?
There's a perception among some folks that GPLET is this incredibly prevalent incentive that the city provides. Almost all of them were developed on sites that were vacant lots, where you essentially, in many cases, had out-of-town, you know, a speculative interest just kind of doing the land speculation thing downtown. You know, I would view it more as helping the positive nutritional value of some of these vacant pieces of property to really evolve and develop and be contributors to downtown.
David Kreider is president and CEO of Downtown Phoenix Incorporated. Dave, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Steve.
Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane has proposed changing how members of the City Council are selected. At this point, the six council members and the mayor are all elected at large. Lane wants that modified so that three of the members will represent specific districts and three will continue to be at large. At Tuesday night's council meeting, the idea was panned and received very little support. Mayor Lane, why do you like this so-called hybrid idea of districts?
In reviewing not so much the performance of how the at-large representation has worked for us, because I think it has worked reasonably well for us, but there is a segment of the population in South Scottsdale that does feel, and there's some reality to it if you relate to just the where a representative councilperson lives, that they were on the short end of it and have been for a long time. The last time somebody actually served out a term, that someone who resigned, was over 10 years ago, about 12 years ago. And he actually did not win re-election. And prior to that, it was probably 10 or 12 years prior to that before anyone else had been out of the southern part of town. So the idea is the representation is good, but the perception is, is there somebody really on council that actually lives and breathes and works and thrives in South Scottsdale that may see things from that perspective a little bit more exclusively?
You mentioned the word perception. Do you think there has been a practical situation, though, where whether it's folks in South Scottsdale or other parts of the area that have actually gotten short shrift, or again, is that just perception?
I think it's perception because this is always a matter of some judgment. I lived for the first 14 or 15 years in what would constitute South Scottsdale. And I've since been moved for the last almost 29 years now to an area that's what could constitute middle Scottsdale. But I think it really is more a matter of perception when a decision may or may not go their direction, because I do believe that each of the members, no matter where they're from, are working not only for the overall interests of the city, but also are very concerned about our neighborhoods, no matter where they may be and the individual constituents within them.
Are there different ways you'd approach it? Are you going to put it on hold for a while? What's the next step?
I would have to tell you, I was a bit surprised by the reaction, first and foremost. So this was only the initiation of a review and consideration of a structure like this for a ballot or for an issue that would be put on the ballot for the general population to vote on. As it was, that came as a surprise. Now to the point of where it goes from here, right now the council has been pretty plain speaking. They're not for any districting, not the hybrid, and not for any districting. That's what was said by, you know, the majority, other than Suzanne Clapp and myself.
Well, Scottsdale Mayor Jim Lane, thanks.
Very good. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you.
John Washington, Scottsdale advocate and publisher of ScottsdaleTrails.com and ScottsdaleCitizen.com, thinks the current council arrangement should change, but not to what the mayor wants. So, John, what system are you in favor of?
Well, ideally, yes. I would like to see us go to what was referred to in the early 2000s when this was tried once before as a straight six or completely district representation, where we have six districts and then the mayor, of course, would be elected at large. I think that would be the best of all possible worlds at this point, and I don't really see much advantage to trying to split the council into, you know, some district representatives and some at-large. It doesn't make much sense to me.
Based on what the mayor had said, he feels like South Scottsdale is underrepresented. Do you think there is that special need, or is that overdone by some people?
Well, I think the real divide in Scottsdale is not a geography divide. It's a divide between diverse interests. And on the one hand, you've got the citizens' interests, and the citizens are interested in their property values and their quality of life. On the other hand, you have business interests, and you can divide those a little bit further. The small businesses tend to be more in alignment with the interests of the residents, but the larger businesses, and particularly the businesses that dominate the Chamber of Commerce, which would be businesses associated with the liquor industry and with development, have a lot of money to throw around, and they have contributed a lot of money historically, and it's well documented that they've contributed to the mayor's campaign, and they've contributed to the other council members who have been in the majority on these development issues. Mm-hmm. So these issues affect the city equally, north and south. They typically come to a head more quickly and earlier in the south because we have more activity going on in the south. I believe that, you know, south of Old Town, south of the downtown area, is kind of the stepchild of Scottsdale, unfortunately. You know, and when they redrew the legislative, state legislative districts, and the south part of Scottsdale got lopped off and lumped into Tempe, the mayor in an interview actually said, and, you know, I can say this with some humor, although I kind of object to it, that, you know, that was kind of okay with him.
All right, let's come back to what you think might be the better idea, the idea of having six separate districts, each represented by a member of council.
Right.
What do you think changes if something like that were to happen in the future at some point?
I believe that with a district representation model, you would actually have the opportunity to go out like they did in old school Scottsdale politics and actually walk door to door, like Jim Lane did in his first campaign, and a number of us have in political campaigns in Scottsdale. I think those days are over. I think, you know, you can't cover North Scottsdale that way. You can't get into a lot of the gated communities that way. The only way to reach these folks, you know, short of ads on cable TV, which even that is kind of dying these days, is to put those mailers on the kitchen table. And that's expensive to do for a candidate to cover the 100,000 or so, you know, voters that they need to cover. So we have this situation where with the at-large representation, you know, those elections are accomplished, the wins are accomplished with mailers and other forms of mass media, mass marketing. And with a district representation model, you have a lot less area to cover, and you can actually burn the shoe leather and cover those smaller districts under that model.
John Washington is a Scottsdale advocate and publisher of ScottsdaleTrails.com and ScottsdaleCitizen.com.
Arizona is one of the hottest states in the country when it comes to temperatures and real estate. And our state leads the country in building energy-efficient, ENERGY STAR-certified green homes.
Our building envelopes have become tighter and tighter, and homes are more and more energy efficient. Even the new build stock, hugely energy efficient. We're number one in the country per market share for energy-efficient production-built homes in the entire U.S. is here in Arizona.
Scottsdale realtor Jan Green is one of the leading green home experts in the Valley. She says she's seen the market change for several years as consumers realize that going green can save them money. KJZZ's Lauren Gilger talked with her more about this. And Lauren, first of all, I've got to ask, her name really is Green?
It really is, and she swears it's only a coincidence.
All right. So what does she say is driving this green homes market here in Arizona?
So she says it's two-pronged. Builders are taking advantage of incentives and rebates, and it's just what people want. The National Association of Realtors did a survey that showed heating and cooling costs are important to almost all home buyers, 86%.
That's what people recognize the most, is that you can dial your dollars down and do those things without adding solar panels.
And builders are also getting on board. The National Association of Home Builders recently did a survey and found by 2020, more than half of home builders around the country plan to be doing 60% or more of their homes, quote unquote, green.
So what exactly makes a green home?
A lot of things, it turns out, from little things like using LED light bulbs to big things like paying for spray foam insulation. So I toured one Valley home that was built to be green with another realtor who specializes in green homes and the man who's planning on buying it.
Beautiful.
Valley realtor Ali Alassadi opens the door and walks inside a brand new house in Arcadia near 62nd Street in Osborne.
A lot of thought went into the design, and one of them is to allow light in. So you can see there's windows up there.
In the middle of the day, the house is filled with light streaming in from giant windows and glass doors on all sides of the modern home. No light bulbs necessary.
Got a dining area here.
Even if they were on, they're all LED bulbs, Alassadi says. It's one of the things that interested Dr. Ahmad Kadim in the home.
A lot of windows, a lot of light.
He's in the process of buying it.
And after going through what goes into the home and how the home actually manages to save you a lot of money, despite it being really open, you know, the floor plan is open.
He didn't set out to buy a green home, but when he thought about it as a long-term investment, he was sold.
Definitely worth it, because down the road you will be saving tons of money, tons of money. And it's more, I would say, more durable.
There's a bedroom back here. It's a master bedroom.
The two-story house and the small development that's being constructed around it was built to meet the Environmental Protection Agency's Energy Star certification standards. That means it meets a set of rigorous standards set by the EPA that the agency says will result in up to 30% energy savings compared to a typical new home.
One of the things you will see in a green home is more about what you don't see than what you see.
Energy Star certified homes like this have high performance doors and windows that are sealed tight, efficient heating and cooling systems, low flow faucets and shower heads, and literally thicker walls.
The framing, where they use 2x6s to allow more insulation inside the building.
This house even has a moisture detection system to improve air quality and a ventilation system that balances the air conditioning throughout the house.
So when you step outside, you can see the same thing.
And Alassadi and fellow green realtor Jan Green agree the market for homes like these is only growing.
I started to recognize that homes were becoming more and more energy efficient, and the building codes, when they come out every 3 years, they're even tighter envelopes. So it's only going to get better.
And that goes for new builds and retrofitting older homes, Green says.
And I think there's a lot of people, whether it's political reasons they don't want to pay a utility bill, or whether it's just to save in their own pocketbook and knowing they're doing the right thing.
And she says that means a lot for the environment as well.
The one thing that people don't understand is our homes are the biggest contributor to greenhouse gases. If we can lower our energy bills, we lower our greenhouse gases. That's huge.
That was Valley Realtor Jan Green along with Ali Alassadi, both of whom specialize in green homes and are spreading the message. Alassadi teaches classes about green homes to other realtors through the Arizona Association of Realtors, and Green works with the U.S. Green Building Council to help train appraisers on how to value green homes, which is obviously really important to anyone looking to sell one of them.
So, Lauren, it sounds like there are some upfront costs associated with having these homes. Are you going to pay a lot more for a green home?
Yeah, so studies have shown you might pay about 5 to 10% more for a green home. It depends. But they also add value on resale. And when you're living there, the EPA says Energy Star certified homes save homeowners about $300 a year. And each one reduces greenhouse gases by about 3,700 pounds per year. To match that, you'd have to plant about 43 trees.
That's KJZZ's Lauren Gilger. Thanks, Lauren.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I got three. Hi, I'm Devon Foster with the Arizona State Rugby Team. Right now we're prepping for our game on Saturday at the Scottsdale Stadium against the Mexican national team.
On the hop, let's go!
They're an older, experienced side, so we're really hoping to use our youth and our speed to counter them and what they bring with their experience and their size.
Crouch, bind, set.
Hitting a guy full torque, only your body, is it's a very humbling experience.
Enter, right now.
Nice. Good job. In the first practice, I actually came out here, and I'd never been hit harder in my life. And I was hooked.
That's Davon Lorenzini Foster practicing with the ASU men's rugby team. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to throw us off the pitch, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
In KJZZ News, an Arizona lawmaker is planning a referendum to undercut a ballot initiative recently launched by a pro-solar group. KJZZ's Will Stone reports.
While it's still being drafted, Republican State Senator Debbie Lesko says her referendum aims to protect all ratepayers and not privilege just one industry, namely rooftop solar leasing companies. This comes after a pro-solar super PAC launched an initiative last week to lock in place certain policies favorable to rooftop solar, including net metering, that reimburses solar customers at retail rates for the excess power they produce. Lesko says placing that in the Constitution is wrong.
Total greedy move by these rooftop solar companies, and it will be at the expense of everybody else that can't afford to put rooftop solar on their house.
Lesko's referendum will essentially contradict some of the provisions being advanced in the pro-solar initiative. Backers of that argue it's essential to stave off attacks by utility companies and ensure state regulators don't implement discriminatory charges against solar customers. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona fire officials are predicting an active fire season this year. They say conditions are reminiscent of 2002 and 2011, which led to the Rodeo Chetiskay and Wallow fires, respectively. Jeff Whitney is Arizona State Forester.
In looking at our forecasts, the drought conditions, fuel conditions across the state at all elevations and all fuel types, one of the things that we in the wildland fire community believe is that we do have a tendency to look at patterns and outcomes, and fuel conditions, moisture regime, drought conditions today being what they are somewhat reminiscent of 2002 and 2011. And we had some significant fires in those 2 years. We have a relatively active fire season on average, somewhere between 7 and 10 years. And the last 2 years have been about half of what we typically see in terms of acres burned and numbers of wildfires. And so we are concerned that this year could very well be a significant fire load for us across the state at all elevations.
We've heard from some climatologists that this year's El Nino was not as robust as predicted. Did that play a role in your prediction for what this year's fire season might look like?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we found in looking at the record was that even though an El Nino was predicted, 8 of the last 11 since we've been tracking it have been average or below average and haven't really developed into what we would consider a big snowpack year, which was the thing that we were really hoping for.
Are there particular parts of the state that you think might be in more jeopardy this year for lots of fires than others?
My concern for various parts of the state are centered around the different kinds of fuel conditions and what we would consider our normal fire activity periods. This year, we already have seen considerably more fires than this time last year. For the first quarter of this year, we've seen about 100 more fires. Last year, we had about 150 fires. This year, we've already had about 250 fires. Virtually all of them are human-caused. Our fire activity has been markedly higher. This time last year, we'd only burned about 453 acres, and so far this year, we've burned over 20,000. So we've had some large fires, not only in southern Arizona, where we've got a pretty robust standing crop of cured perennial grasses, but we've also had some large wildfires around Flagstaff and over in the White Mountains. We had a 600-acre fire probably 7-8 weeks ago over in the Clay Springs area. And those are pretty good indications that this is setting up to be a rather active fire season for us all.
Jeff Whitney is Arizona State Forester. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Wildfires are a major force on the landscape after they're extinguished. That's the finding of a new paper from scientists at the University of Arizona who studied areas of the Valles Caldera National Preserve in New Mexico. John Pelletier is a professor of geosciences at U of A and the paper's co-author. John, what were you looking for in this research?
So it's been known for a long time that wildfires increase erosion rates for a short period of time, typically about a year following the wildfire events. Storms will come through, and the erosion rates will be higher than they are without the wildfire. But those events are relatively rare. So what we wanted to look at and investigate and quantify is the relative importance of wildfire given the fact that it doesn't occur very often, but its effects are significant on the landscape. So there's been a debate in the scientific community about whether wildfires are more important in terms of the total amount of erosion that occurs over long timescales, or whether they're less important than sort of everyday floods that occur in the absence of wildfire effects.
And did you find that they are more or less important?
We found that they were more important and dramatically more important. And so at least in the Valles Caldera, where we were able to bring together several different data sets to quantify erosion over short timescales with and without the effects of wildfire, and also over longer timescales using a couple of different techniques, we were able to quantify that over geologic time, so over timescales of millennia and longer, wildfire erosion is more than 90% of the total erosion that occurs. So even though you could be out there in the landscape and measuring erosion for your whole lifetime, but if you weren't there when a high-severity wildfire occurred, you wouldn't be measuring the event that actually does most of the work on the landscape to change the landscape.
Do the changes tend to be the same regardless of where it is? In other words, are there some areas that have had severe wildfires where A has happened and another area that was affected by a big wildfire where B has happened?
Definitely there are variations in the response. And I would say that we've studied the Valles Caldera in detail. And in this particular region, wildfires are very important because the landscape is relatively gentle. There's very little bare ground, so the forest is very thick, the understory vegetation is very thick in the absence of a wildfire. So in this particular environment, I think we have the recipe for wildfire being very important because there's very little erosion that can occur in the absence of wildfire. But in other environments, if you go to steeper landscapes, landslides in the absence of wildfire may be more important. So yes, there are spatial variations in how the landscape responds to wildfire, but in almost all cases, the increase in erosion rate is at least a factor of 100 above what we call the background rates.
Does it matter what was there before the wildfire? Like if there was a desert wildfire versus one up in like northern Arizona where it's more pine tree kind of environment?
It absolutely does, yeah. So in this case, we're really talking about forested landscapes, and we can also get geomorphic effects after shrubland fires and grassland fires, but they typically tend to be not as dramatic in terms of the erosional response. And that could be a function of the fact that when you have more biomass in the landscape, when there's more trees, and the forested environment is thicker with vegetation, the fire burns hotter. And its effects on the landscape are greater relative to what the kinds of erosion that occurs in the absence of wildfire. So if you have more vegetation in the landscape, the normal erosion that occurs in the absence of fire tends to be lower because you've got vegetation as a protective effect on the landscape. It also, when you burn that fire at high severity, there's more of a change that occurs. So the fire actually gets hotter, the soil burns more you know, at a higher temperature. And that leads to more hydrophobicity. Hydrophobicity is the repellency of water by soil that's been burned. And so all those effects will increase the amount of runoff of water that you get for a certain amount of rainfall. And it's really that runoff that is driving the increase in erosion. So we get a lot more water running off the landscape. It acts less like a sponge than a normal landscape does in the post-fire environment. And that's what's bringing down the rock and soil.
John Pelletier is a professor of geosciences at U of A and the co-author of a paper looking at how erosion after wildfire shapes the landscapes. It's in the Journal of Geophysical Research. NASA has awarded ASU $10 million over 5 years to develop new ways for us to learn about space. The university expects to have its first module finished by next fall. Lindy Elkins-Tanton is the director of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU. And Lindy, what's behind the grant?
NASA's decided that they really need to renovate their education and public outreach programs. What we're going to try to do is, in our case, bring NASA science content and NASA mission content to people in gameful, small modules that really engage people's sense of exploration and questioning. We're trying to create really engaging science content at scale, which requires us to go out on the internet. It reaches many more people. And I think a lot of us have had the experience, especially in middle school and high school, of being taught science as a series of facts that we're supposed to memorize. And that is misleading on so many levels. First of all, it gives you the idea that everything's been answered. So how can you imagine yourself to be part of that enterprise when everything is already done? And so there has to be an entry point for people. And the entry point is the process of science, which is really a way to ask questions about your world, a way to create answers.
So when I was in school, and perhaps when you were in school as well, when we learned about space, they had like the big giant foam balls that were sort of to scale of the size of a planet, and they were colored in, and they were on sticks, and you had them in the right order. What you're talking about does not sound like that.
Right. So I hope everyone knows their planets, and we can, you know, we can cry over Pluto, but definitely still in the crowd. No, we're trying to look at this as more of a way of life, that everyone should feel empowered to ask questions, seek for answers, look for solutions in whatever is facing them in their day-to-day lives. And we can model that by looking at space information, which is so interesting to so many people. And so indeed, like an example might be, going to go onto this web application that we're producing, and one option might be to have a virtual field trip on Mars, where right in front of you on your monitor you would see the highest resolution images that are available from Mars, and you would be able to walk through the Martian landscape, asking questions and interrogating the landscape and learning from it. Another example might be, say you wanted to learn about an icy moon. Why are we interested in going to look at icy moons? Why do we think that's a place where life could be? Well, what if you were faced with a simulation of the ocean inside of the icy moon Europa, and you were asked questions about how that water was moving and why it was moving, and you were able to zoom in and look at the currents, and then you would have a sense of how to get answers. So that's more the inquiry that we're looking at.
Who is your audience for this?
Initially, NASA is asking us and the rest of the teams, and we're all working very closely together, to work with informal learners. And so we're going to be working with museums and libraries and after-school programs, and then looking within the next 2 to 3 years to transitioning over to the classroom.
What happens when somebody is asking a question about, let's say, Mars? They're taking the virtual tour of Mars. What happens when they get to a question for which you don't have an answer?
That's the best. Isn't that the best? That's the best because if there's nothing already built into the module that allows them to answer that, we'll have ways that they can contact us. And the best of all possible cases is that it's a question that no one has an answer to, because it shocks students sometimes and adults alike that even within an hour or two of thinking about something, they can think up questions that no one has an answer to.
What do you think is behind NASA's desire to change the way that people learn about space?
Well, I think that it's pretty well accepted, and we can all think of examples that space travel is incredibly inspiring to a lot of us. And I think that NASA would really like to maximize that impact. I think that this is a real world good. This is something that is actually a force for peace and a force for imagination. And one thing that NASA's discovered is that when you work individually with teachers, it is so rewarding for everyone involved.
Lindy Elkins-Tanton is director of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at ASU. Lindy, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
A recent analysis of how much it costs to live comfortably in different American cities caught our eye because it used Phoenix as the baseline. The report cited Arizona's capital city as one with a moderate cost of living and a median income that's close to the national average. To get a sense of what that means, we turn to George Hammond, director of the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the U of A. And George, first off, do you buy the premise of using Phoenix as a baseline for this kind of analysis?
Well, Phoenix is probably a useful baseline for this particular purpose because Phoenix's cost of living is very much in the neighborhood of the national average. And, you know, overall, our median household income, at least as it's currently measured, is also close to the national average. So it's you could also think of the data in the article as reflecting the differences in these cities from the U.S. as a whole.
What does that mean for this city and the greater region that, you know, the cost of living is what it is? As you say, it's close to the average. What does that tell us about this area's economy?
What you want to keep in mind in terms of these cost of living measures is that they're designed to highlight differences across metropolitan areas. So, for instance, what we see is that while Phoenix is very much close to the national average, metropolitan areas like San Jose, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., those metro areas have a cost of living that's in the neighborhood of 20% higher than the national average and 20% higher than what we find in Phoenix. So kind of what you notice from this is that the cost of living, including, housing, purchasing goods and other services, is a bit cheaper in Phoenix than it is for some of the other major metropolitan areas that we often compete with for residents and businesses.
I would think that would be a check in Phoenix's box as opposed to some of those cities.
Absolutely. Some of the cities that are a bit closer to home, Los Angeles, San Diego, their costs of living are, in the neighborhood of 18% above the national average and roughly that above Phoenix, according to data from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Is there a danger, though, that as more people see a particular place, be it Phoenix or anywhere, as a place where the cost of living is maybe a little more reasonable than where they're coming from, that they go to that city and with them sort of bring up the cost of living for everybody else?
Certainly can happen. That tends to happen to a much greater degree in cities and metropolitan areas that are particularly geographically constrained in some way, whether they're hemmed in by geography or other factors, for instance, restrictions on building. That can really drive up the overall cost of living, particularly the cost of housing.
So the fact that Phoenix has a lot of land around it seems like it would be maybe a way to sort of mitigate against that happening.
Absolutely. That can be one factor that can help.
When you talk about the factors that go into cost of living, how big of a driver is housing relative to the others?
Housing tends to be the biggest single component. It can, account up to 30% or so of what goes into the overall cost of living. So it's a big deal.
George Hammond is the director of the Economic and Business Research Center in the Eller College of Management at the U of A. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein. That's G-O-L-D-S-T-E-I-N, and I just used it in a sentence.
Mark, that's pretty good, although you've known me for a while, so it shouldn't be that hard to spell.
No.
How about autochthonous?
I think I'll leave that one to the real spelling stars. We'll be taking over D.C. next month to compete in the Scripps National Spelling Bee, and getting there isn't as easy as ABC. The show's Annika Klein spells it out for us.
Sharon Schnitta, S-C-H-E-R-E-N-S-C-H-N-I-T-T-E. Sharon Schnitta.
Correct.
That was the winning word in last year's Scripps Bee. Oh, and so was this.
Nunatak. N-U-N-A-T-A-K. Nunatak.
Correct.
It was a tie. But both winners look exuberant, and they should, considering what it took to get there. See, the Spelling Bee is actually a numbers game.
The Scripps National Spelling Bee program each year involves more than 11 million kids across the country and around the world.
That's Paige Kimball, executive director of the Scripps Bee and 1981 Bee champion. She says the kids at the National Bee are funneled from smaller bees held in every U.S. state, territory, and commonwealth, and five other countries. And if they make it to the final round of 12 students?
We're talking about the top 0.001% of the Spelling Bee participating population.
And she says the population is still growing. This May, 285 elementary and middle schoolers will go to Washington, D.C. to spell it out for the top spot.
All right. How about tachistoscope?
Tachistoscope?
Mm-hmm.
Nicola Ferguson is practicing with her dad, Chris, over their dining room table.
Does it have anything to do with vision at all?
It's an apparatus for their brief exposure of visual stimuli.
Nicola won this year's Arizona Spelling Bee, hosted by the Arizona Educational Foundation. It was her first time in a state-level bee, so it'll be her first time going to nationals, too.
Where is it from?
It's Greek.
They spend maybe a half hour a day studying. Nicola's pretty busy. When she's not spelling, she's reading or practicing the violin.
Like when I first get home, my first thought isn't really, I need to prep for the spelling bee. It's usually, I need to get my homework done as fast as possible so I don't have to worry about it.
She's got a natural talent for spelling new words.
Tachistoscope. TACHISTOSCOPE.
But she'll also have to remember the three C's: calm, cool, and collected.
You're watching the Scripps National Spelling Bee on ESPN.
ESPN broadcasts the final round on primetime, creating buzz around the bee and even more sweat about being on stage.
It's pretty intimidating for those kids when they get to that level to be able to compete.
Babia Boyle is executive director of the Arizona Educational Foundation.
And I think it takes a certain amount of poise and confidence and just getting those nerves settled down at that level because it's a huge deal there.
It can feel so tempting to focus on the numbers. Will I make it to the top 72? The top 12? Top 2? But Nicola and her family want to enjoy D.C. too.
She's a marine biologist to be. So what actually excited her the most is going to the Baltimore Aquarium. So I'll probably do that.
That way the time I spend before the spelling bee will be happy. So like if I get out, then at least I will have seen the fish.
And who knows? The name of one of those fish could be the winning word this year. Barramundi, anyone? For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.